Today is reunion day, kind of, on In Depth with Francis Rose. It's a reunion of the office of the Deputy Chief Management Officer at the Department of Defense, and I'm happy to welcome both of you. Have been here since you've left DOD, but you haven't been here together. It's Beth McGrath, now at Deloitte. It's great to see you, my friend.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Thank you for coming in. And Dave Winogrand. And I note, just very quickly, Dave, that you were here about 3 months ago, and that was the first time you'd been here after you'd left the Department of Defense, and you have a new job already.
Yeah, time flies.
You come in here like, I hope now that you're going to be at the Professional Services Council for a little while.
Well, I wasn't looking. It was a great ride at CACI. They took great care of me, a great company. But Professional Services Council made me an offer that was just too tailor-made, I'll say, to my passions and interests. I just couldn't pass it up.
It sounds like a terrific fit, and we'll talk more about what's going on there in just a couple of minutes. Beth, you're staying in the game. You are not wasting any time at all in continuing to talk to people about what's going on in this space and the issues you care about. You were just before the House Armed Services Committee testifying to them. Tell me what you were talking to them about, what they wanted to hear from you at the committee.
So both House and Senate Armed Services Committees stay very close to the acquisition process. And I'm sure you're aware of the letter that was issued jointly by House and Senate in the March timeframe, really looking for both industry associations and government in general to give them feedback on, you know, what's working, what's not, because they're really trying to take a very thoughtful approach to, you know, is there something that can be done, should be done, either from a legislative perspective, you know, more legislation, less legislation, streamlining those kind of things. And so the hearing last week was really focused on getting a, you know, former federal officials to the table to say, well, tell us what it was like while you were there, and really an opportunity for us to share perspective.
Did you get a sense of what Chairman Thornberry's areas of interest are that might be different than the last time HASC went down this road, what, 2, 3, 4 years ago, something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, it was about 3 years ago. It was probably 2 or 3 years ago. I'm sure I testified then as well.
You did.
I did.
I covered some of those hearings.
Thank you. Clearly, we didn't fix it just yet. But I think that, you know, coupled with the fiscal pressure the federal government is under, with the, I think, desire by both the federal government and industry to, you know, to make the process better, to deliver the outcomes, you know, I think that they are really just trying to figure out, you know, why isn't it working? And I also think this is more than just the weapon system perspective. It's easy to have focus on the big end items and the big dollars that are spent with the weapon systems, but I think the aperture is wider this time. And is looking at both weapons system services is a big topic. I think that's certainly louder today than it was a few years ago. And IT continues to be a persistent conversation that the federal government is having.
Dave, the changes that are going on here touch all of the areas that you dealt with, not just when you were in OSD working with Beth, but when you were at the Navy and the CIO there, and then moved up to the agency-wide level. So what is this? What does it look like now from the outside that people are paying so much attention to the issues that you had your hands on every day of your life for a long time?
Yeah. There are a lot of changes going on, and I know I start my conversations with you about the pace of technological change, mm-hmm. but it is just fundamental shifts in the markets for, I'll say, for professional services and technology. And so these opportunities exist now to do what I will describe as convergence. And in the old days, you either used to buy IT hardware, software, but now professional services, technology solutions being married together into capabilities that are delivered. And then you have this the whole model about a capacity on demand, consumption-based models, cloud computing being just one example, but you can pick business analytics, mobile computing, all of them are this shift about, instead of building a system or just buying services, you're going to get some kind of solution that you can buy capacity on demand. Mm-hmm. And so it has a whole bunch of advantages to the government in terms of you don't have to have a lot of upfront capital expenses. You know, particularly in tough financial times when you're not sure how much money you're going to get next year, there's been a lot of, I'll say, delay. So governments sometimes defer starting the new initiative, is unsure how much they're going to have to spend. And so in my time in the private sector, I've just really been witness to, you know, the disruptions that are taking place because of uncertain financial times. And one of the prizes of these consumption-based models is that you don't have to make a big upfront capital investment. You can buy capacity on demand as you need it, whether or not it's for infrastructure or services or applications. And so so these kinds of shifts are just providing huge opportunities, but they require us all to think differently. Mm-hmm. Government has to buy differently. Industry has to offer differently.
You used to alluded to something a moment ago about budgets that I think is noteworthy, and that is this word opportunity. I hear it a lot more around this situation of the budget than I ever expected it to. Is it either becoming or already a forcing function of some sort that is making people do things that they wouldn't have done otherwise?
I do believe so. And I think that, you know, the government managers have a particularly difficult situation because, you know, between sequestration and even though we have a budget now, what's going to happen in a year or two, right? So you have this like big drive now to use IT as a way to reduce operating costs. And so, you know, the government IT leader is being driven about how are you reducing costs? How are you reducing costs? Oh, by the way, where's my innovation? Because as Beth and I saw in the Department of Defense space in the business spend of $7 billion or so we spend on business IT systems, 75% of the money was going to sustaining the old and only 25% was going to developing the new. So if you couple that sort of disproportionate spend on the old with maybe not as much new investment money, you know, you're really going to have to think differently if you're going to be able to keep costs down and yet have agility and speed and...
You were nodding your head in agreement with Dave when I was talking about the forcing function thing, Beth, and it strikes me that it's not only making people think do things that they wouldn't have done otherwise, it's making people do things that they still don't want to do now, but they realize they have to, and those changes aren't necessarily always for the bad when you talk about some of the, or think about it in the context of innovation like Dave just mentioned.
Yeah, and I would add to Dave's comments in saying that, take shared services, for example. Shared services doesn't come naturally, I don't think, to many organizations because it really is allowing someone else to do work on your behalf that you have done yourself for a very long time. And so there are many in the workforce who would think they're relinquishing, you know, their jobs to someone else. And certainly the new organization can't do it as good as they can. And so there's a real trust factor in shared services.
Mm-hmm.
But with fiscal pressure being what it is, I think it does open up people's thinking to, is there a different way? And if someone is proven in a capability like payroll or HR or something like that, and you could actually buy a good product from somewhere else, I think it does... actually enable that conversation to happen today, whereas before it just wouldn't because people weren't willing to and they could afford not to.
You are very diplomatic when you talk about shared services and you say that concept doesn't come naturally. That's a very diplomatic way of saying it, isn't it, Dave?
Yes, it is.
I would say that mostly my way of looking at it would be that from what I understand, most people find it abhorrent. The idea of doing shared services. There's a tremendous amount of apprehension, reticence, resistance to doing it. And I'm not sure that I see that resistance being broken down nearly as quickly, especially as the administration would like.
Yeah, and I think that it really does depend. I think you need some really forward-leaning people to really engage in that conversation constructively. Because I think it's both the, am I willing to buy the service from somebody else and am I willing to be a shared service provider to another entity? I mean, I've talked many times about we have service providers in the Defense Department. We have service providers in the federal government. And I actually think, you know, taking a look at how well do we, the government, provide some of the services is worth doing. To take a more business perspective around both cost and performance and customer service, as we would as, you know, I'll just say independent consumers. I mean, we want a good product for a fair price, and we want the quality to be good. And so I think there's a lot more to a shared service conversation than saying, oh, we should do more, because it's both on the, I'll say, the buying end and the selling end that it matters.
Some of it's still definitions, though, Dave. Yeah. I'll give you an example. I had a conversation recently with a bureau-level CIO at a non-defense agency, and we talked about shared services, and I said, how do you feel about the concept overall? And he said, I would be pleased to, we have all kinds of things that we can provide to my colleagues in the other parts of the agency. And I thought, no, that's not what your agency level CIO has in mind. That's not how he's thinking of it the same way you're thinking of it. So not everybody even really agrees on what the delivery of these services are going to look like.
Yeah, it's almost counterintuitive because, you know, we all love personal control. Mm-hmm. And we feel better when we have the money and the equipment and everything and the people, and we can just do what needs to be done and not have to rely upon other people because we're always concerned the other people won't delight us. But, you know, nowadays in this consumption-based world that we were talking about a few moments ago, I mean, you're really going to miss out because you're not going to be able to keep up with the pace of technological change. You're not going to be able to make the continuing capital investments. You may not have the cutting-edge people on your staffs anymore. And so you're going to like send yourself down a path where you're absorbing all the risks yourself and not taking advantage of the partnership that either industry has to offer or the center of excellence is going to be the provider of a service.
The interaction with industry becomes particularly important in a shared services environment because, I mean, we're all aware of the idea of how every agency wants it done their way. What do you think about the communication level that you saw both recently inside and now that you're on the industry side outside the agency? Beth, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I'll start. I'm sure Dave will add significantly.
And be glad that you started,
yes,
too, by the way.
Yes. So it's really interesting. I mean, I think actually I made a statement in the hearing last week that said, you know, I feel like government and industry have forgotten that we're on the same team. I think there are vast improvements we could make regarding how and how often the federal government and industry actually communicate about what is the requirement. And I know we're trying to ensure that there's a fair playing field and there's plenty of competition. And I'm not saying that those things aren't important. I guess my plea would be to find a way to enable more and better communication between government and industry. So at the end of the day, we get the outcome that we're after, be it the, you know, the end item weapon system or the service, as we've been talking, or a successful IT implementation. I think the more the team communicates, the better the outcome will be.
I'm sure you both heard, too, from many people in industry that they would like to be involved in that conversation earlier on so they can help you and help the people that you're serving and the warfighters who eventually will use whatever product or service it is that you need, help make everybody aware of what all the possibilities are before you set in stone what the requirements are that you're going to wind up buying.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the reasons why I'm at the Professional Services Council. We've set up a technology policy council for just that reason. In the year that I've been out, you know, I was sort of, it was intuitively obvious to me, but it really is sort of like imprinted upon you, the wake-up call about the impacts that happen from, I'll say, misapplied requirements or restrictions that get placed. And so often the times they're not statutorily prohibited, but we go all silent. We don't share communication. We should, we don't take advantage of, proactive contracting approaches that might allow us to do something different and things like that. So the whole idea behind this Technology Policy Council is to get industry leaders engaged in a dialogue with government about, hey, there is a bold new world out here. And things like cloud computing and mobility are just the first waves of how work is going to be done radically different. And if we put the best minds of industry and government together, we can find out ways to deliver things faster and better.
Another thing that you testified about, Beth, before the House Armed Services Committee last week was incentives. And I think they are very important to getting us to actually making the changes that we talk about all the time. We'll discuss that more when we come back in just a moment on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. Dave Winogrand, Beth McGrath, my guests. We'll continue in just a moment.
Kimberly Hancher, Chief Information Officer at EEOC on Connected Government, How to Build and Procure Network Services for the Future. Panel discussion sponsored by Hughes, an EchoStar company.
And what I like to do is look at our current costs, look at the GSA-provided VoIP offer, and also compare it to commercial VoIP offerings. The one thing I know is that I don't want to be a VoIP service provider for my agency because mm-hmm. we're just too small.
To listen to the whole program, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Is your agency struggling to find reliable and affordable network solutions in the current budget environment? Consider Hughes Managed Broadband, which brings multiple broadband elements to locations where most network providers can't reach. With more virtual bandwidth, Hughes Performance Optimization Technologies deliver bandwidth-hungry applications faster than ever and with industry-leading security for a fraction of the cost of major providers. To learn more, visit government.hughes.com.
Our federal employees have played an important role in upholding our national values and beliefs. GEICO would like to recognize their contribution and wish all federal employees and their families a very happy and safe 4th of July weekend. For over 75 years, GEICO's been helping federal employees save money on their car insurance, and they'd like to do the same for you. So if you're a federal employee or belong to a federal association like BIG, FLIOA, or NARF, find out how much you could save with a federal employee discount. Don't wait. Go to GEICO.com today or call 1-800-947-AUTO to get a fast, free rate quote. That's GEICO.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. Keep all your weekends safe and get peace of mind with GEICO Auto Insurance. GEICO, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Federal agencies are increasingly the victims of advanced persistent threats. Now more than ever, federal agencies need advanced protection to identify and stop attacks that break through traditional defenses. Tune in to Federal News Radio 1500 AM on July 17th at 9 AM to learn how agencies are protecting themselves against APT and zero-day threats and the proven methods they're using to protect, detect, contain, and resolve targeted threats. July 17th at 9 AM, sponsored by FireEye.
A long holiday weekend is coming up, which means my family will drive from Baltimore to Ocean City soon. That also means that that Maryland accent will start popping out in the most unlikely places. Marvin Bond, editor of Recreation News, has some ideas that even longtime Ocean City travelers might not know about.
We take a look at what's new at the Maryland Beach Resort and how some of the longtime favorites have changed in a special story in our July issue. Take a look at restaurants, microbreweries, and some of the changes at longtime Ocean City hotels that you might be surprised about. Find out some more on this in the story that starts on page 14 of the July Recreation News.
Hey, Marvin, I'm going Danny Ocean. You got anything good for me down
there? There are always some deals you can find. The Clarion Resort is offering a Super Saver Sunday package for three nights that start on any Sunday during the summer. You get food and beverage credits of $150. You can find out more about these deals on page 14 of the July Recreation News or, as always, at recreationnews.com.
Marvin Bond is editor of Recreation News. I'm Nicole Grisco.
The Federal News Radio Community Spotlight is Vehicles for Change, a unique nonprofit repairing donated cars and providing them to low-income families. A car is the most valuable poverty-fighting tool that can be provided to a low-income family. It increases the opportunity for better employment and allows children to participate in activities never before possible. Vehicles for Change has awarded over 4,700 cars since 1999. For more info, visit federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Radio charities are fed by Papa John's.
Find every Federal News Radio story and interview on the federalnewsradio.com news stream. A quick look at the latest news as it's posted to federalnewsradio.com.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Beth McGrath and Dave Wintergren, both formerly of the Office of the Deputy Chief Management Officer at DOD, my guests in studio as we continue our conversation on the changes at the Department of Defense and the landscape of this, as I've talked about it with a number of guests in the last couple of weeks, is in many of these on many of these issues, there's a lot of agreement. There's agreement across the political spectrum. There's agreement on both sides of Capitol Hill. There's agreement in the various offices inside the Department of Defense, at least that things need to change, and in many cases, what those changes should look like. The implementation is the sticking point. You testified, Beth, at the House Armed Services Committee about incentives, and I wonder if you can expand on what you told the committee about incentives, why it's so hard to change them, and what changing them would look like and how it would impact some of the areas we've already discussed, like innovation and acquisition and so on.
Yeah, so some of what we discussed were around incentives really focused on the program manager is incentivized a certain way, certainly to deliver against cost, schedule, and performance of whatever it is they're delivering. It seems that a lot of the contracting community, however, is more focused on sort of price. There's a price incentive or a cost incentive. And also the users or the requirements group, because the program manager isn't the, you know, the definer of the requirement. He or she is the person to deliver the service and item capability. And so if you take a look at those three groups and say, you know, how is the requirements team incentivized and what happens if something does or doesn't work? Is there any sort of penalty or reward for that community? And most times, you know, there isn't. Yes, they're delivered a capability, but if things don't go well, there's usually no negative impact from a, you know, removal from job or things like that. And but if a program doesn't go well, people are always looking to who's the program manager, and he or she is, you know, I'll say dealt with, depending on the circumstance, what that is. And the contracting officer, I frankly am unaware of an instance where if a program did not go well, and again, this is just in my experience, that there was any sort of even feedback loop to say, well, you know, how could we have done that better? And really looking at the whole thing, because there have been plenty of reports done on, you know, root cause analysis. I think, you know, PARCA and many other organizations have done root causes. But I just wonder, you know, have we really looked at the incentive structure to say, do we have alignment with incentives such that everybody's working toward the same goal? And when things go well, then there's a benefit to the group. And if things don't, then you know, we've got a feedback mechanism to ensure that we fix that. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't seem to me that there's alignment today with the various communities who, you know, it takes a village. To deliver, I mean, pick one, an IT system, an end item, certainly a major weapon systems. It's a very big village to get that thing done right.
It's a fascinating pendulum swing because, you know, years ago, the program manager team, the people who needed the result done were in the driver's seat, and the organizations like the contracting officer were there to help make sure things got done. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of like the analog about FSMA and some of the complaints about that. If the outcome is, you know, I got all the paperwork done right, and something wasn't protested, and you have a set of expectations about that you're incentivizing, then it's not about the mission result. And so sometimes we're losing the bubble on the, you know, it's about a mission result, and everybody should be incentivized about that.
Mm-hmm. We just have a minute or so left, Dave. Beth mentioned about industry being so concerned about pricing. I think they'd turn it back on the department and say the reason that they think and focus so much on pricing is because that's their interpretation of what the department's expecting from them. Is that fair, do you think?
Well, I do hear that said, but, you know, I think Frank Kendall has been really clear in his better buying power guidance in the Defense Department that things like low price technically acceptable have a place. They have a place for really well-defined commodity kinds of buys. And if you're looking for thought leadership and things that require, you know, new ideas and approaches, then best value is by far the better way to go than low cost.
I have a list of about 20 more questions, topics that I'd like to cover with you, and I have no time to do it. So I'm going to make you come back as summer progresses, and we'll do this again. It's terrific fun to see both of you individually, and to have you together at the same time is even better. Thank you both.